What's up, everybody? Honestly, I've got nothing tonight before we get to it. I figure you guys are probably tired of hearing about Overmatch every episode, so I'm going to give you a break. And I'm still working out some plot and sequencing issues with the new sci-fi project, as yet untitled. So I'm not telling you about that either, even though I told you I would a couple episodes ago. I'm going to keep the new book of mystery. Because I can, and you can't stop me. So take that. Caveat, one second. I was lying just a little bit, because it'd be irresponsible as of me as an author to sit to not say, if you haven't yet, go get Overmatch, read it, write a review, good, bad, or otherwise, because I can't wait to hear about it. And that's it. I did lie to you, but I only lied to you just a little bit. And I'm still not going to talk about the new book tonight. So there, we got half honesty, half lie. And if you can get that on anybody, I think you're probably doing pretty good this day and age. So let's get to it. Tonight, we're going to chat with Mike Bachman, horror and thriller writer. Mike Bachman writes horror thrillers and other stories while his kids are in gymnastics class or piano lessons. He lives with his wife, Sarah, two daughters, and an exceptional duo of wiener dogs who I just had the pleasure of meeting. So first book that really grabbed my attention was Fantastic Land. And in Fantastic Land, since the 70s, Fantastic Land has been the theme park where fun is guaranteed. But when a hurricane ravages the Florida coast and isolates the park, the employees find it anything but fun. 5 weeks later, the authorities who rescue the survivors encounter a scene of horror. Photos soon emerge online of heads on spikes outside of rides, viscera and human bones littering the gift shops, breaking records for hits, views, likes, and clicks and shares. Everything goes viral, and the question becomes, how could a group of survivors, mostly teenagers, commit such terrible acts? He's also written a werewolf book called The Pack and a new book called Killing It, and I can't wait to chat about him. So, Mike, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. That was a, I am really tempted to try to see what we can get out of the sci-fi concept out of you because you know we're not starting at a place of dishonesty, John. We're gonna do this.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm not hard to beat. So, because
Cool.
once you start talking books, it's like, all right, let's go. You know, let's just chat
Yeah,
because
let's go.
it could go
Exactly.
wildly in an insane direction. And technically, it's not wrong because we're talking fiction. It's not done yet, right?
Yep, exactly. Yeah. I've had one or two I don't know if you have beta readers or people who will give you good advice on your books, things like that. You were talking about my first book, Fantastic Land. They radically shifted the ending of that book. So it's like, yeah, I love these conversations because it makes your mind a different shape and then you've got to figure out how to make that work in the book you're writing. And it's just great. So
Oh yeah, and yeah, my beta readers are when they're trusted when they're just like they write you a note in a margin that says this could be better, or completely missed it. I'm like, okay, yeah, nice.
I love that.
Yeah, oh yeah,
I take
it's
it back.
you can
I
trust them.
don't. I take it back. I don't love that. I love having someone who will do that for me.
Yes. Yep. And an editor that will absolutely bleed on a manuscript. I'm like, man, if an editor is going to tell me I'm bad, I'm like, I love it because I never want something going out that they're like, ah, I should have mentioned this, but I didn't. It's like, no, we can't
Yeah.
have that. So yeah, it's funny. Fantastic Land. When I was flipping through, I see Fantastic Land and I click on it and the cover, I was like, nope. And my eye goes to the pack. I'm like, werewolves. Yep. And I'm look back at Fantastic Land and I see the blur. I'm like, huh. And it wasn't any, the cover's fantastic. The my
Sure.
immediate thing was when I see Fantastic Land and a Ferris wheel, I was like, that's going to have clowns in it. And I don't do clowns. I was off.
Yeah,
I was way.
clowns aren't my favorite. Yeah, if I can stay away from the spooky, it's the spooky clown genre because it's not fun, but B, it's been done a whole bunch. So yeah, if I can stay away from that, I think I'm in good shape. But yeah, covers are weird, man. I remember we were talking about that with the company putting it out. My one note was, can we get more blood on this? And I never was able to get that to work. Just
Yeah.
tried to generate. Yeah, this isn't YA. You know, we're writing horror here, and it's worked out pretty good for that book, so it's fine.
Oh yeah, it's the cover was great, and but it was only the Fantastic Land part, and I could just picture That creepy clown guy in every Rob Zombie movie.
Him.
It's not Pennywise. Like Pennywise, I'm like, all right, you have a very punchable face, even though you got big teeth. Like, but it's the old dude with the really like dripping clown makeup from Rob Zombie movies. I'm like, nope. Absolutely not.
Yep. You're thinking of Professor Spaulding, played by the late great Sid Haig. Yeah, I love
yes.
Rob Zombie's made a couple good movies. A couple aren't quite my taste, but a couple great ones. And yeah, I remember. I don't know if you grew up in the age. I'm 46 right now, and I grew up in the age of DVDs when they were coming out. And the scariest part of House of a Thousand Corpses for me was the DVD menu was just Sid Haig coming out and yelling at you. So yes. He comes out in that makeup and he's just like, hey, kids, you love blood. And he just keeps, and then he just keeps going and gets more and more annoyed the more you don't push the buttons, you know?
Yeah.
One of my favorite DVD menus of all time.
Yeah. I'm of the same timeline. I just hit 47. So it's like, cool. It's amazing. You know, when my kids who don't understand, like I love seeing them hit an old computer or something and not understand and think it's broken because the touchscreen doesn't work. I love the fact that they've got like Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, Peacock, Paramount, Disney, Nat Geo, all these things. And they'll just sit there and be like, I'm so bored. Like so spoiled. Like stop it.
Yeah. It's the paralysis of too many options, I think is what it is. You know, the idea that if you've got everything in front of you, how do you begin to pick something like that? Which is, I hate to say that we grew up in a better time because it makes me sound exceptionally old and cranky. But I love the idea that, you can watch a Ghostbusters 20 times and pick apart the tech and, know all the lines and your friends know all the lines. And it's like, that's not an experience kids have anymore, which is weird,
Yeah. They can't do it. And they're missing out so much because it used to be like when we were growing up, I don't know if you were a G.I. Joe guy, He-Man guy or Transformer guy, but that was pretty much your options. Yeah. And all the way through high school, we got Friends, we got Frasier, we got everything that everybody made sure they're home on Tuesday night, Thursday night, whatever you got into all through college, we had this. And now kids go to school and they can't have the water cooler talk because they're all watching some other idiot play with toys or eat weird food or do stupid stunts on YouTube and they're talentless hacks, but they have millions of followers. They have no continuity to it.
Yeah. Yeah, you wonder if they're ever going to like, you can reboot something a whole bunch of times, but you wonder if they're ever, you look at like the John Wick franchise, which I love. I think those movies are great. And they made 4 movies and those movies are good. And then they spun it off and now they're doing a thing in Vegas. And now there's another TV show and now there's a spinoff of that. And I'm like, you can take an idea, this cute little idea, which is people doing stunts and this cool kind of criminal underworld, and then just blow it up. And it's like, well, then we're going to have to get the inevitable reboot. It's like, there's no room for something to exist anymore, which is kind of weird. But again, I am fully aware of how cranky and old I sound.
Yep. And I did catch myself the other day. I mean, I'll bag on YouTube all day long. Cause I walk into the room and they get maybe an hour before bed at night that I'll let them watch whatever they want. But if I walk in the room and I see an absolute moron on the screen eating something or just being stupid, I'll walk out and I'll be like, Cohen, that is too dumb for my house. I'd be like, change it. And I'm like, but I love this guy. I'm like, I don't care, because if you start emulating him, you're diminishing the gene pool I brought you out of. Like, just stop. and I did that. I pulled that the other night and I sit down and I start looking at it. I'm like, I remember my dad saying something about Elf. Right. Like, you remember Elf?
Regarded as a classic. Yeah.
Yes. And I remember the same thing with The Simpsons and South Park. The parents hated South Park. And of course I loved all of that stuff, but I remember that distinct conversation, but like, this is so stupid. How can you watch something like this? And I remember being like, cause Peter Griffin's freaking hilarious, and cut it out, you old hag. Right. Now. Yeah. And I'd caught myself. I was like, in that moment, I'm like, yeah, I just did that. I just pulled that same move that my parents pulled.
Yeah. And so it will go. And so your kids will pull it when they're, their kids are got their headsets on or doing VR, or, whatever it is they end up doing. Yeah. It will come back and they will look back at you and go, God, I sound just like my father. And that's how it goes.
I've already promised myself that if I'm like, I'm just thinking, okay, when they're 47 years old, I'm hoping to figure out how to download myself into a robot at some point.
Oh, yeah.
But by that time, like, I'll be like, oh, you wanted the holodeck? I'm sorry, I'm 96 years old. This holodeck's mine.
Well, Mike, I got a kid who's a sophomore in college right now. And I remember getting in her car and we were driving to Target or something. And she was, she has like a big mix of music she's playing in her car. And I recognized like three of the songs. And I'm like, oh, you poor girl, I've influenced you. I was kind of hoping you'd break free and find your own stuff, but also that stuff would be cool. So there's a fine line, is my point. And I'm trying to figure out how to be a good influence while not, you know, I don't know.
I think I honestly think Marvel we were talking about it, like every movie now is professional wrestling or has to come with a franchise tag. Yeah. But I will say Marvel, for those first few movies, they pulled some amazing classic rock out, and my 11-year-old came about right at the right time that he has an appreciation for the 80s hair bands and the old hard rock that is impressive, drives my wife insane sometimes, because on top of that, they've got the maturity level that I carry. So my 6-year-old, like, what do you want to listen to, Cohen? He'll be like, break stuff. I'm like, is that Limp Bizkit? And he's like, yes. I'm like, shit. I'm gonna hear about that one.
Limp Bizkit. Oh my god.
Yep. So
yeah, I always tell my kids, there was a time that I lived through where our culture collectively took a hard look at the Foo Fighters and a hard look at NSYNC, and they broke the NSYNC, and I've never forgotten that.
Yes, exactly. It's like, oh, how could you do that? The boy bands. It's at least they're gone now, and they're back, but it's back ironically. Like when I see new kids are together, I'm like, I enjoy that, because they're just wider now and they don't move as good.
Yeah, that was my wife's jam. So yeah, it's like that's the thing I get to shake my head at, and she gets to, you know, shake her head at a whole bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, I think that kind of dynamic produces very, very healthy children, when they're like, oh, they see each other rolling your eyes at each other, and they can choose to be like, well, in this case, mom's taste in movies are way better, dad's music's way better and more violent.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like we were those kids dressing, or we were those parents dressing the kids up a little too gory for, you know, for first grade. So yeah, it's a good time.
That's an amazing question. Okay, yeah. As a horror writer, like, yeah, where's the limit? Yeah. And what was that conversation like?
Well, we tend to go over the limit all the time, but I remember it was one of those things where early on, it's like, yeah, horror's always kind of been part of me and what I do. And ever since I had a really good time getting scared. And I always use the line that I like to tell people that I've watched complex movies and read complex books, and I like to think I could understand them and discuss them. You know, if you put a Antonioni movie in front of me, I can probably figure out what's going on, but I'm not going to lie to you and say that my favorite movie isn't Return of the Living Dead, because it is, you know. Yes. the punk zombie movie, you know, from Dan O'Bannon, it's like that is my jam. I'm not going to lie and say I didn't drive, you know, 2,000 miles to visit the graveyard from Night of the Living Dead, because I did. Nice. You know, and there was a drive-in there, but it was still there, and it still looks exactly like it did in Vandergrift, Pennsylvania. So yeah, I mean, the horror's always kind of been not far from the surface. And so when I decided to get my shit together and write a book, which was a little later than maybe I wanted to, that was the natural place to head to.
Yeah, I still remember the first horror movie, and in the 80s, the parents were like, go for what's the worst that can happen, right? And it was a Silver Bullet. It was a werewolf, and I think that created my love affair with werewolves. Just the Corey Haim and that thing, and Corey Haim in the wheelchair, and that part in the woods where they're chasing this guy down, and he just shows up and whacks a dude's face off. I'm like 9 years old being like, oh, that's how it works. I'm like, yes.
Something has changed in my brain. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think you're uncommon though, because I mean, like, I always tell people, you know, Stephen King has sold more books than anyone else who's alive. And the only person who has outsold Stephen King literally is God. You know, the Bible, literally. The Quran, the, you know, yeah, literally the only person on the planet who's outsold Stephen King is God. So horror is, it's, it's kind of treated, you know, we push it away a little bit, but it's always just kind of there. It's also one of the last two dependable movie genres, you know. It's like, as studios go through this big change they're going through right now, horror is still the thing that gets kids to the theater. And I love that. I think that's fantastic.
Yeah. And I remember a couple of years ago when they started putting out like the Annabelles and they started getting back into that, that slasher type film. And I remember being like, I wonder if that's going to work. Cause the Friday the 13th, the Freddy Krueger, the, all those slasher ones from back in the day, we got like 13, 14 of those movies in them. And they start doing that. They start hitting that sequence again with, and it wasn't even Saw. I want to say it was like Annabelle or The Conjuring. And you started getting those series again. And I saw it taking off. I'm like getting a little Wild Child back, because that horror is that last like primal callback that we have. You know, we all live in these nice suburban bubbles, and we can walk back and forth every place in relative calm without worrying about the monster creeping through the bushes or sneaking around the corner or coming out of the shadows. And you go and sit in a movie theater, you sit down with your friends, and you just get those jump scares. And it's like, yeah, that it still gets you a little bit.
Oh yeah, totally. Totally. Have you ever seen, it came out online not all that long ago. There's a now famous photo of one of the first screenings of the movie Alien. So it's this black and white image, and they got a bunch of people and they took their picture just as the chest burster happened, right? As the alien came out of Ian Holm it was sprayed blood all over the place. And the picture centers on like seven people, and six of them are going, various recording. And one guy's sitting there going, And it's like, I kind of relate more with that guy, you know, because I like being scared. I like the horror, I love horror movies, but when something gets me, it's not, it doesn't like hit me deep in my chest and radiate out. It's like, it gets the tingles. It's just like, hey, yeah, that was pretty good. Yep. And I think that's, you know, that might be a product of me not being, you know, violent in real life, kind of being sheltered and suburban and not a lot of things to come and creep around my neighborhood and around corners and stuff. But that's kind of how I react to those things. I love it. And I'm sure you do this too, when you come up with something particularly good or particularly gnarly or something, where you're writing it, you get that same kind of buzz. You're just like, oh, this is going to work. This is fun, you know?
Yep. Yeah. And I still like to this day, the best compliment I've ever gotten is I was walking through a store one day and this lady's like, yeah, I had to sleep with the lights on like 2 days in a row, like, because of what you did. I'm like, well, but I can't wait to hear what you think of the next one. I'm going to try and outdo myself. It's, oh man, it's just so good. My kids still do it today. Even at like 11 and 6, they're still like creeping around in the dark every now and then, just trying to they still look for that little bit of fear that's there, you know, and we live in Mayberry. So it's like, you got to look for it.
Oh, you know? I really like that part of it though. I mean, the escape valve part of it, you know, I mean, brilliantly talked about, if you ever saw like Cabin in the Woods, that's kind of what that movie's about. It's like watching horror movie, people watching a horror movie, you know, and it's like, oh, this is why it exists, so that the monsters don't really come out, you know. It's like, I love that.
I think that's also why Craven was such a genius. I mean, everything else Wes Craven did, when he took Scream and turned the whole thing on itself and made it a comedy, it was like, oh man, it was one of those movies where you're just like, okay, he just started something new. Like it still worked though. It still got the jump scares. It still got the intensity of it. And then you got the laugh in the middle. And even at the end, like when Skeet Ulrich is and what's his name are bleeding out, you're just like, you guys are hilarious. Yeah. It's like, I'm going to miss you guys. Like, you guys are hilarious.
I'm losing a lot of blood here.
Yeah. Exactly. I'm getting woozy.
Yeah. Get a little woozy. That was it. You got it.
Yeah. So when it comes to horror, there's like, I think, two relative options. You've either got like the creature you can't see, like Jaws for a little bit, or you've got the just straight up in your face freak show bloodbath. Do you have one in particular you like, or did you evolve from one to the other?
Good question. Where it kind of depends on like what sort of mood I'm in. If you're talking movies and there's a difference between like having a good time with a horror movie and then just kind of getting unnerved. You know what I mean? Like there's a, I saw a trailer for a movie, I think it's called Spike. It's about a kid who adopts a spider and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And as someone who's not super fond of spiders, I looked at that and was like, that's going to be a bad, good time or a good, bad time. I'm not sure which one, you know, but either way, it's going to creep me out. But then if you want to go for the stuff that actually scares me, you know, it takes a real different tack, you know. In film, it's stuff like David Lynch, for some reason, just kind of gets under my skin. There's a scene in Mulholland Drive that I always point to as one of the legit scariest things I've ever seen. Reality breaking down is kind of what freaks me out a little bit, you know, just the idea that things are not dependable all of a sudden, and these things, you know, it's like this place that you thought was safe is not, this thing that you thought you could touch can't, you know, however that works. And there's some really good movies out there kind of in that vein, so it kind of depends on what I want to do. But when you're talking about books, the thing I love right now about horror, and I don't know if you're, you know, big into the space, but right now horror is kind of having a moment in literature, and everything is out there. And that's like the best part of it, is that if you want to find splatterpunk, you can find it. If you want to find deep psychological literary stuff, it's out there. If you want to find, you know, kind of your Grady Hendrix horror laced with a lot of comedy, that's out there. If you want to find your, you know, your Paul Tremblays or your, you know, Jeff Strands, if you want to go a completely different direction. And there's just so much out there that is so good that I really always encourage people to get out and just read a horror book, you know, and it maybe not even one of mine, just get out, read a horror book, engage with the community because they're welcoming and you can find whatever you're in the mood for. And that's pretty cool, I think.
Yeah. And that's what I love most about going to book conferences, especially when they're not niche, when they're not genre conferences. You get to not only, you know, chat with other authors, but you get to see that mental process, get to see how they come up with their ideas and then kind of dive into their world for a minute. And it's everything. Like you said, I was doing keyword analysis for Amazon ads the other day. And I'm just, as I put in horror for Shattered Circle and Inquisitor, I put in horror and then all the derivations that come with it and all the interest there is. And it gets wild. Like it gets the different genres that are fully available is just unstoppable. But what you said with the creepiest part of your side of horror is like seeing that line of degradation, that line of chaos, and Fantastic Land. I think that was the creepiest part that got me was, you know, the premise is everybody's locked into this theme park and how quickly the world devolves, like how quickly the lack of supplies drives not only chaos, but it also brings out absolutely the side of humanity that would never show up. Was that whole thing like a planned treatment of your exploring that concept, or was it one of those things that was just like pop in my head? I was like, oh yeah, I gotta do this. I gotta go dystopian in a theme park.
the idea, yeah, good question. Basically I'm more of a pessimist by nature, unfortunately, just kind of the way my brain is built. So when I took my aforementioned kids, who are now considerably older, to Disney, as every American couple does at some point, while they're having fun, I'm kind of looking around going, okay, what could go wrong here? You know, and that was like the genesis of it, is just kind of getting a layout at the park and seeing this giant operation. And as someone with military ties, I mean, you would know how quickly, when something gets big and bulky, that means there are so many cogs going, which means so many things can slip off the wheels, which means so many things can break down, which means more things can, you know, that sort of idea. And so that was where the idea came from, is not even like, I'm not even like a super theme park person. I've never worked in a theme park, but you know, you can kind of do your research and swipe, you know, layouts of the park and get some of the details right. But the basic idea of how can things go wrong in a theme park basically is because I walked around a theme park wondering what could go wrong. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's go ahead. Sorry.
I'm a lot of fun at parties. So
Well, that's inevitably every time we go to the theme park, I have a role to play, and we have an understanding when we go into that, and I'm the pack mule. Because if my wife, she's a nurse, but if she had her dream job, it would be the social director on a cruise. Like, it's just, if there's something going on, she wants to be a part of all of it. And like, just like you, like, I get into that big of a crowd and that big of a closed in environment, I'm like, I'll carry the bag. And now I'm looking for the bad guys. Like, I've got these two little guys right here, and I'm trying to figure out who here out of the 100 people I'm surrounded with is the biggest problem. And that's how I, so she's like, why? And inevitably we'll be walking around, she's like, why are you so quiet? I'm like, I'm good. She's like, you don't seem like you're having a good time. I'm like, oh, I'm having a great time. I'm like lining up my suspects as I'm like watching everybody, you know? Also at the same vein, when I sit down in a roller coaster or something, I'm like, how high was the dude who last checked these bolts? Like,
a 1,000%.
Yeah. Like, I know that you can't get through a job dealing with that many children and that much stress without some weed. So I'm like, how high was this dude? Like,
That's like one of my favorite parts of Fantastic Land that I don't know a lot of people remember, but it's like the most visceral part to me is this guy is knocked out at one point. He's being dragged through the back of a ride, and he keeps thinking, I know where the bolts are, a bolt could catch my head and just tear my head wide open, you know, and he's hoping in semi-consciousness that doesn't happen. And that came from looking at bolts, you know, while I'm in line going, oh my god, that looks like an accident, you know, that sort of
thing. That's a problem.
It's a problem. So just that mindset is where I think there's a lot to be mined from as a writer.
You know, with that, as I'm getting through it, and like we talked about earlier, like as I'm starting to read this, I'm like, yeah, I want to talk to this guy. This is just so much fun. I'm not all the way through it, but just the way that you told it, because I'm like, as I'm reading, I'm like, how did you land on the perspective that you did? Because I'm like reading it, and I'm like, if I told this from Brock's perspective, he's not the guy to tell it from. And then I'm like, Austin would have been a good line. Pounder would have been a good line. Yeah. So as I'm reading this, and you told it in a historical perspective, going back and kind of dissecting the event like a war correspondent or a documentary. And I'm like, as I'm reading it, I'm like, I love this because I love that format. But for me, I don't know if I would have immediately, if I've got this idea in my head, I might have been like, who's my hero? And like I mentioned, Austin, you had Austin as a hero. And then as I'm reading, I'm like, well, no spoilers, but
things didn't turn out too well for him. Yeah,
that would have been a short book.
Well, yeah, it's I think part of that comes from my time as a reporter. I was a newspaper reporter before newspapers ceased to be a thing for about 7 years. My wife and I met, at a newspaper, and so it was that was part of it. Is it, you get real good at or it. You know, I don't want to say I'm great at it, but because it was a big fear, but just listening to people talk and trying to figure out what it is about their voice and how they talk that conveys who they are, right? So if someone's, you know, gruff, you try to find a quote that conveys a little bit of that gruffness. If they're, you know, or just whatever that trait is, if they're very formal, you want to portray them that way because that's how they're speaking. So when I decided to do it that way, I loved the idea that I could kind of peel away the layers of this thing as it went. And the thing that was kind of cool about it, I mentioned earlier that I had beta readers who changed the course of the thing. I wrote it discovery style, so I didn't map it all out beforehand. I just went back and, you know, drew connections once I was done with it. But the original ending was very different. And, you know, my beta reader said, man, this ending sucks. You're going to have to fix it, you know? And so... And of course they were able to point out, well, you've laid this, you know, this track here, but there's nothing on it. And you've made this promise and you didn't keep it. You've done all these different things. So that was really helpful and really helped with, you know, the kind of format of it. But yeah, I kind of like how it was written and it lended itself really well to the audiobook. So.
Yeah. I can't imagine. Every chapter, you know, every interview, every interview your perspective goes into, it's the different personalities are just so you're so good at just introducing them. And it's like, and it, within the first like page, you're just like, oh, there's a, you know, this is a story of survival. And the next page, you're like, this guy's an asshole, you know, and they're like, oh, here's another story of survival, you know? So it's,
nobody's the villain in their own story.
And nobody's a villain in their own story, but there's like, yeah, I'm going to cash in on this. I already made my deals. Like, oh, okay. This, you're doing great, bud. I can't wait to see you on the outside, you know?
And it's
so hard to say some of this stuff without, cause you don't want to spoil it. Cause everybody has to read this. It's such an original look at a way of doing it. I mean, it's got that World War Z feel to it, but it's such a deeper dive into humanity it was just fun to watch it devolve and meet these people on the front end and some of them on the back end and see how it went through. But yeah, like you were talking about earlier, it, as I'm reading it, it reminds me of a run on toilet paper in 2020, or the burning down buildings because we're not happy with who's elected to office in 2020. It's like how close, it's like a finite edge. Somebody, you know, one headline can drive an entire industry into the toilet, and it's like, damn, you know, it's not far off.
Yeah, being a pessimist is no fun, but it allows you to kind of pay attention to what's going on. Yeah, I wrote this, I think 2015, 2014, somewhere in there.
Oh, and you're prophetic.
I hope not, but I've never really had a hugely high opinion of people, you know, and that's that is not special among me. I mean, a lot of people feel that way, but we were talking earlier about the different times in which we grew up. You know, I grew up in the time where, you know, someone would take you out on the playground and punch you a couple times, you know, and you get that sort of sense of things and how quickly those sort of things can go south. And that's one of the big complaints about the book. If you read the, if you read it, just a second, I'm sorry. Yep. Sorry about that. If you read any of the critical reviews of the book, which is great, you know, but please, you know, you read my book. I'm just happy you read it, you know, but they say that it devolves too quickly and people wouldn't go crazy that fast. And I'm like, I don't know, man. It sort of feels like, especially now, we're in an age where things can go south pretty quick. There's that old quote: "What is it? Society is just 8 meals away from chaos," you know, something like that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it's nice to be comfortable, and it's nice to live in a nice place, and never forget that you're not far away from having your neighbor come over and try to take what you have.
Yeah, and it's
but it's how my brain goes.
Yeah, I mean, it's just basic resilient outlook. And I, you know, we already talked about how we're sounding like grumpy old men, but resiliency is not an apparent thing in our society anymore. Like people want people charged for mean tweets at this point. It's like you can't live your life by your life is disrupted by a troll or a bot online who said something mean to you. Like, how are you going to handle it if somebody takes you out on the playground and slaps you around because they don't like the way your shoes look, or you scuffed up their Jordans? Like, what? How are you dealing with that? How are you making it through your day? Mm-hmm. You know, somebody doesn't hold the door for you at the coffee shop, and suddenly your world collapses. So, how far away are people like that from you? They're shriveling up into a ball or turning into Brock.
Yeah, exactly. Or going the other direction. That's a real good way of putting it. Yeah. You know, just turning into a charismatic person who says, okay, those people go get them, you know. And that's just as bad.
Yeah. And it's like, I don't know. I mean, it's not that, you know, you don't want to be prophetic, but if, I mean, it's a cult of personality. You wrote a cult of personality on one side and everybody's dealing with it on the other. But I mean, history is just full of people doing horrible things that they would normally never do just because there was a strong leader who gave them a goal of, I follow this person, I'm safe. I'll do whatever insanity keeps me going longer because this strong person is leading the way, and they'll just do it. They fold in a heartbeat.
Yeah. I think that was, thank you for putting it that way. I said it better than I could, because that's like the framework I was going for is get people uncertain, get people scared, and then introduce violence ever so subtly. And it was a mercy killing, you know, this is something you can understand. And yet at the same time, all of a sudden everything has shifted. I'm sorry, Jesus. I'm going to go grab a thing of water real quick.
No, go ahead, man.
I apologize. Yep. I'll be right back. Hey, I'm sorry about that. Much better.
Not a problem.
Used to talking this much about myself.
Right.
But, Yeah, but the idea that once the permission structure is there, then things go south, you know, kind of predictably fast. And to me, the other thing is that, like, I think I have this in the book. I'm pretty sure I do. And if not, it was in my head when I was writing it. Just, I don't know if you've ever had one of those moments where you're looking around and it's like, there's no civilization here. You know, it's like, oh wait, this is literally law, you know, law of the jungle, or just, you know, and look, I'm like we said, I'm a weak dude, you know, I'm a 46-year-old guy who's on two medications, and you know, I'm not some big strong survivalist guy, but just kind of keeping tabs on just how delicate society is, I think is something that makes you respect it more. And maybe fight for it more, and maybe pay, if nothing else, just pay attention to it more, you know, and figure out what a future without those sort of comforts look like.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, like, you go ahead and do that mind experiment with it, and you know, in 2020, if people weren't having conversations on what do we do, or planning ahead, or war game in the situation, yeah, a little bit, they're irresponsible. But, you know, but then you get with those people who just can't face, there's some people that also just can't face the idea that I won't have, you know, these authorities here to keep me safe. If I get in trouble, I call the police, they're going to get there. And then when you tell them, if you call the police, if they can get to you within 7 minutes, they're beating the national average. And if somebody's actually trying to come in your door, they're going to be dead. They're going to be done with whatever they want to do and gone before the police get here. And then the ambulance is going to take 15 to 20 to catch up with them. So but there's people that can't see that. They refuse to see that there is a need for resilience and independence in the world. And that just, when you lay it out for them in 300 pages, they're like, no, this is fiction.
Or, you know, I'll do you one worse, food supply. I live in Nebraska, right? And the town that I live in, basically we manufacture farm implements, meat, and bullets. You know, that's nice. Like where I live, you know? Yeah, so those are the three biggest manufacturers in the area. And so once you know, and you talk to farmers, and like I said, I was a reporter for a while, so you talk to farmers and you talk to ranchers, and you kind of get a sense of that fragility out there too. And it's like, well, man, you know, a bad year and things look real different. You know, never Google how important phosphorus is to our food supply, you know, those sort of things. Yeah. So, I don't mean to jump in and be super negative and scare people, but like I said, that's how my brain is, built. And then you throw climate change in there, which is like the main thing that kind of drives the events of the book. And yeah, just pay attention a little bit, have a little bit of forethought, and I think you'll do better than most people.
Yeah, just have a plan. And it's always funny when, especially when I'm reading something like this, or we're, you know, talking about this or watching chaos on the news, I'm always like, mm-hmm. I live on a barrier island on the east coast of the United States. I'm like, I can't go to the ocean. like there's no evacuating east. And if evacuate west, no. I'm going with the other 100 million people that are all trying to go to the same place because they think the mountains are safe. It's like, I've misplanned on where I put down roots. Yeah. like I think I'm in it for the long haul. Let's just build an arsenal and some cement block buildings.
and yet at the same time, let me not be full, you know, full prepper here and just say that. The other thing that's cool about Fantastic Land that I want to make sure to get in there is that, yeah, there are moments of humanity. There are moments of grace. There are moments of people fighting for one another. There are moments of creativity, you know, like what the freaks do and how they kind of get around their situation, you know. Humans are beautiful, terrible things. And the older I get, it's like the more stark contrast you see between, yeah, someone can give you the shirt off their back and then be a terrible racist person, or someone can be, you know, kind to your kids and, you know, burn down a church or whatever, you know, whatever it is. Yeah. You just see the dichotomy of people so much more. And it helps, you know, it's a terrible thing to kind of be a pessimist, but it also helps you recognize the beauty in a weird way. If that makes sense, you know, just kind of grab everything you can, experience everything you can, have joy where there's joy to be had, and maybe don't take things quite so seriously that aren't so serious, and I don't know that you're going to get all that out of the book, because my main goal is to make you go, ew, gross. But you know,
yeah, it's still, right.
It's still, that's where my brain was while I was thinking about it.
Yeah. And it's I always tell people that I judge every person by an individual. Mm-hmm. And you qualify people by the way I interact with you on an individual basis, but humans as a pack are something to watch, as it's either going to be really good, and it can go really bad in a heartbeat, and it doesn't take a whole lot of them. It's what is it? The ratio is what, you know, out of a group of 100, you get 5 or 6 people that are willing to stir it up, and the mob mentality just exponentially takes over the group. It's the mob, the group think COVID, and mob mentality freak me out.
Yep. There was no need for a toilet paper run, man. Everyone had plenty of toilet paper.
Everybody had toilet paper. Yep. It's, and I just remember chuckling, like turning down that aisle and just chuckling, just being like, "Ooh, there are some scared, paranoid people out here that I share this community with." And it's, it's,
they're still out there. And I think that's why my next book went a little lighter with the werewolves, and then a little meaner again with the third one. But yeah, you can't live in that space. But if you just let it occupy a little bit of your brain, I think you're healthier for it.
Yeah. And it's a fun experiment. It's like, I don't have an arsenal, and I'm not a prepper, but it's like, when you think about it, it's like, yeah, if things go really bad, I'm probably in a really bad spot, you know? And then you're like, well, okay, I'll move on to what's on Instagram right now. And we'll think about that later.
Exactly. Exactly. I'm going to go watch my kids' show choir. It's going to be beautiful. These kids are going to be enthusiastic and happy, and it's great, you know?
Yeah, yep, exactly. And and I haven't gotten the pack yet, because like I said, I'm a sucker for a werewolf. I love the werewolf genre. And I think it goes back to like Silver Bullet. And they kind of ruined it a little bit with Teen Wolf, because I'm like, there's werewolves don't play basketball. I don't know if like when it comes to the classics, the werewolf, the ghost, the zombie, the vampire, do you have a favorite? Like, was there a reason that you were like, I need to write a werewolf book? Because I'll tell you, on my list, I'm working space opera right now, but werewolf is on that list. Like, I will write a werewolf book at some point. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I'll tell you where that one came from is, I don't know if you've been to the Midwest, and I'm sure it's like this everywhere. There was a hotel that was kind of out in the middle of nowhere, and it faced a kind of a forested area. And there were two chairs, and the chairs, kind of like deck chairs, you know, were facing the woods. And I just looked at that for a long time and thought, what are they looking at? Like, you know, why, you know, there's nothing out there. And so that was kind of where the idea came from. And so it's basically a werewolf story set in a real small town. And the way these, you know, werewolves work are very particular. And it's almost, this is going to sound weird, but it's almost more of a family drama than it is a werewolf book, although people do get torn apart fairly effectively. It's, you know, it's about this group of people who are, you know, desperately broken, you know, Sons of Anarchy kind of style, except instead of motorcycles, it's, you know, claws and fangs, and that nice. That was kind of where that one went to. So yeah, that's kind of what to expect.
Yeah. And the small town thing, I grew up in a town of 5,000 people surrounded by cornfields, lakes, you know, in upstate New York. Yeah. And it's just that small town feel lends itself so perfectly. Cause like, as I don't know where, if you grew up in the Nebraska, in a small town area, but like high school parties were seldomly within civilization. It would be in the middle of a farmer's cornfield with a bonfire 8 feet high, you know, an abandoned farmhouse or something like that. And it all just lends itself, you know, you're partying like a rock star, getting hammered, and the darkness is just all there. So it just lends itself to that. What else is out there? Those people who live way, way out in the country that only come into town like once every 6 months, are they out there watching from the dark? You know, how does this work?
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. Absolutely. I have been exactly where you described. Yeah. It's, you know, that is a dark, unlike a lot of other darks you've ever seen. It is just you know, dark, dark, dark. So
Yeah, absolutely. And but when it comes down to classics, is werewolves your absolute favorite? Or
good question. I think werewolves are pretty close, at least you know, if you're talking like the universal monsters, the one that I think holds up the absolute best is Creature of the Black Lagoon. I don't know if you've seen that recently, but that is a good movie. It's like you don't need to remake it. It already exists in this kind of great space. And if you haven't read there's a book, the girl from the Black Lagoon, it might be. Anyway, it's about the history of the person who designed the Black Lagoon outfit and has some great behind the scenes stuff about that movie. That one's my favorite, but like in terms of just sheer, you know, what's going on, there are so many iterations of vampires, and Frankenstein is more of, you know, its own thing. And the mummy, the zombies, the creeping death, that is definitely cool. I honestly go off on a little bit of a tangent and say I think part of the warning signs that said that things were maybe going a little bit more angry in our area or in our country was when The Walking Dead became big. Like I watched that with people around me and thought, people are watching this because this is what they want to be doing. Like this is their fantasy, right? This is what's in their head sometimes, is that they really want to shoot their neighbor. And if their neighbor happens to be a monster, that's fantastic, because then they get to shoot a monster. But if not, you know, maybe I'll still shoot, you know, Jed across the way. But yeah, werewolves were always kind of the best, because it's that dichotomy of like control and not control, and being able to you know, violent versus not violent, the whole waking up, what did I do sort of thing that Lon Chaney Jr. did so well. That's some primo, you know, primo old time monster stuff right there. I love it.
Yeah. That old loss of control.
Which one is yours?
Oh, it's hands down werewolf. Just because of that just, you know, disappearing, running, you know, all of a sudden having the power, strength, endurance of a wolf and the ferocity of a monster.
Yeah.
And then flipping that switch the same way is I've always liked that one. But yeah, to the point of The Walking Dead, I remember thinking the same thing. Like, people are way too into the downfall of society. Like they really think that this would be fun. And I'm like, man, this would suck so bad.
Oh,
like,
it would suck so bad.
And the one thing that I remember one upped it, because we had, you know, The Walking Dead hit, it just starts building and goes crazy after that first season. And then I think The Purge came after it. And I always found The Purge creepier. I don't think it was nearly as good of a story. But, you know, the way The Purge caught on, I think they're in like part 6 at this point of the movies. But that's even worse, because, I mean, you're like, hey, it's not only that you're hoping to find a justification to kill your neighbor, so hopefully they turn into a zombie and you're saving your family. No, it's just, guess what we're doing? We're suspending the world, and you can just go kill whoever you want, and people are partying. Like, no.
That is a great high concept. And then the idea that the rich people are actually behind it running the whole thing. It's like, that makes so much sense. Those movies, I'm a fan. So.
Oh yeah, they did pull it around, especially with an outlook like that of society, of just being like, they're just doing it for sport. It hasn't changed since the time of the Romans. The rich people are just throwing the Christians and the lions. They're just letting the streets do it. It's just amazing.
I am jealous of that high concept that they came up with, because it's just such a great idea.
Yeah, it's like, I wish I'd have come up with that. Oh man. So when it comes down to it, I mean, from Fantastic Land to the Pack, and with the new one killing it, when it if somebody were to say, you know, when it comes to authors for you, who was it that you read and you were just like, I'm going to do that. That's how I'm going to.
Good question. So I draw a little bit from books, a little bit from movies, you know, a little bit from everything. And if you're a writer, that would be one of the things I say, is just like taking a lot of art, you know, get a lot of sense of what other people are doing, and then put your own mark on it, right? That would be a big deal. So like for Killing It, for example, did you ever see the Jeremy Saulnier movie Green Room, about the punk band? Patrick Stewart was in it, and he played a neo-Nazi.
Oh no, I gotta see that.
It's a brutal little movie. It's one of those movies where you're watching it and there's a moment where a thing happens where you're just like, whoa, this movie is not messing around, right? It's like all of a sudden you're like, okay, this just, I don't even want to say elevated. It's like, okay, so the stakes are much, much, much higher than I thought they were, you know, that sort of thing. And that was where, you know, where I pulled from Killing It, was the idea of the concept of it is, you've got a guy upstairs who's kind of losing his mind. There might be a little bit of a supernatural shining sort of element to it. And you've got a bunch of comedians downstairs in a green room where the cell phones don't work and the internet doesn't run. He is up there, has bad intentions. They are down there wanting to get out and game on, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it was the simplicity of that And the idea that it let me really go to some gross, to really develop some characters and then do some really mean things to them, you know, that kind of is where that came from. But I find more and more as I go through, and this is weird because Fantastic Land is not this, but I respond to stuff more and more where that's the case, where it's like, okay, you've developed someone who's in a situation I can relate to, or who is, you know, whose motivations I get, or who I just like hanging around with, right? And then bad things happen to him, and it's that old Stephen King quote, you know, make them fall in love with your characters and let the monsters out. And yeah. That guy might have been onto something. But in terms of authors, the people I like right now, again, it's kind of mood dependent, but and there's so much good stuff out there. I love me some Paul Tremblay. I've read most of his stuff. If you want really straight ahead, kind of muscular, no nonsense horror, there's a dude named Jeff Strand. I don't recommend him to everybody because he's a little grosser than most, but he's pretty good. So I like Jeff. I like I just finished Sundial, and I can't remember the name of the author, and I really should. I'll look it up on my phone real quick while I'm talking. But it's one of those things where it's like a little bit serial killery, little bit a mad scientist, but like also very, very rooted in relationships. Katarina Ward is her name, and that one was really good. So I don't have anybody who's like books I buy all the special editions of and you know, go to their cons and worship them, but I'm always kind of on the lookout for the you know, next horror thing I'm going to read. My TBR file is pretty ridiculous at this point.
Yeah, mine gets nuts, especially doing this thing as the side, mm-hmm. the side hustle. Cause that's exactly it. I mean, I flip through, Amazon, or I take, you know, suggestions as I'm talking to people. I'm like, all right, Catalina Ward, I'm checking her out. Tremblay, I'm going to check him out. So maybe they show up here too. But yeah, I still remember my first book I ever read in the adult space, I was like 10, I read Jaws and I was like, man, that was scary good. And then, that turned me into a book addict. Like it'd be pretty much wake up, read, go to school, play lacrosse, read, go to bed. And it was, cool. And I still, to this day, I still have my original copy of Dean Koontz's Watchers because you said, make your characters fall in love and then unleash the monsters. And it's got the dog who I can't think of his name. It's got the dog and then the monster that is that the dog is meant as a tracker and, the monster, I'm not going to spoil it, but I remember crying because of the monster. And I'm like 12, 13 years old. And I'm like, it's the monster. Like even me, as I'm reading it, I'm feeling myself tearing up and I'm like, oh, it's the bad guy. And I'm crying about the bad guy, you know? And it's just, I remember because it had that violence to it, but at the same time he turned it, the emotion on its head at the end of that book. And it was like, man, that's what I want to do.
Yep, that's what I want to do. Exactly. Yep. Yeah. I've got, I think I read a tweet once where someone said, most people of our generation read a Stephen King book too early. Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's definitely me. You know, I found some of his books a little early. The books I remember early reading that I just remember them vividly and more how they felt and how weird they were and how I never really felt comfortable because something terrible could happen at any moment is Clive Barker. I remember kind of falling down a Barker rabbit hole when I was maybe 14. And that is not the age you want to fall down a Clive Barker rabbit hole. That'll mess you up fairly effectively, you know, but like Weave World and Books of Blood and some of those sort of things. And then you take them to school and people think you're weird, you know, and that sort of thing. Right. But it was, there was just the possibilities were out there from very early. I was able to look very early on and say, okay, this can be just about anything. And then wait, they make movies out of these things, you know, and then you're watching movies and then you're, and then it's all over, man. Then you're 46 and you got three books under your belt.
Right. I think that's a benefit we had was that, you know, HBO and Cinemax and all those things were new. Like we're just leaving that space where you had three choices on the dial. And the adults didn't really comprehend it, and they didn't comprehend the the books, or at least the mass market stuff. So at least for me, and I'm not saying that my mom wasn't paying attention, but it'd be like, well, it's HBO, and we'd go out. They'd be the adults would be hanging out in one room, and the kids would be watching, Silver Bullet or Nightmare on Elm Street, and they'd check in, everything okay? We're like, yeah, we're doing great, and they'd leave, and we'd hide under the covers while Freddy's dragging Johnny Depp underneath a bed or something, and with our book, oh, what you reading? I'm like, I'm just reading this. It's called Watchers, and they're like, oh, you're reading, great job, and then today we've grown up with all this media, and I don't know about other folks, but I wanted to keep my kids away from that level of violence to a point. I don't want them to see somebody disemboweled on screen until a certain point. And I'm finding myself failing because of the conversations I have with my 11-year-old. I'm like, he could handle this, and it'd be really cool to freak him out. But I'm like, oh, he can't.
Wait till you read. My youngest is 16 right now, and she's the last one. And we've kind of thrown up our hands. She's right. Like, all right, fine. You want to watch something? Come here. We'll put it in.
But you got to watch the end.
Got to watch to the end, exactly. There aren't a whole lot of limits left, and then she'll kind of shrug her shoulders and we'll watch a hockey game or something.
Right, yeah.
It's cool like that, but yeah, just a different time, but the stories are still the same. The good stories are the ones that stick with you, the let the monsters out. I love that.
Yep, yeah, the lines we talked about right at the beginning was, finding that primal piece of the story and scaring ourselves is the same thing that drew us to it, that draws my 11-year-old to it, your 16-year-old to it, the whole age of today. They're all looking for the same thing. They still want to feel that fear, and escape into it, and then escape right out of it so they can turn the lights on, right?
Yeah, well, there's fear, and then there's just like going into someone's weird headspace, it's like I have a friend of mine who has had a website since I think like 95, 96, where he writes reviews on B movies. And just some of the stuff he's shown me and we've sat through, it's like, how did this person's brain works in such a different way than my, and a lot of times it's not all that wholesome. It's stuff where like, oh, this guy's a pervert and someone gave him a camera and some money. That's a terrible idea, but that's part of it, part of the great, the great horror framework too. But, and you can find those people, if you look hard enough in Amazon, I like to think, that if you grant it humanity and you try to create, characters and situations that people can relate to, even if they're fantastical, even if they're sci-fi, even if they're, a werewolf in the scene or whatever, then you're doing your job as a writer.
Yeah. As long as people enjoy it, that's all that matters. As long as they have had a good time.
Yeah.
Awesome. Hey, Mike, I know that you've got a thing at 8 and we've I usually don't want to keep people past an hour, 'cause I know it's a weeknight and I know everybody's got stuff going on, but, I appreciate you joining me.
No, this is a pleasure. I appreciate it. I'll pitch my books. So I've got Fantastic Land, Pack, and Killing It, which came out last year. And then, if I'm starting with you, where do I start?
If you want to stick with the horror side, it's Shattered Circle was my first book, a fantasy horror police procedural all mixed up into one. And then, then I kind of bounced around. I tend to cleanse my palate. So I bounced to crime and then lost my mind and did a Die Hard in a Castle and then back to crime. Cool. And now I'm taking a shot at a sci-fi book. So we'll see. Someday I'll settle on a pattern.
I've got a, agent who I tried to do that once after I did Fantastic Land and Pack. I turned in a book that was a little bit more Nick Hornby-ish, trying to talk about music and some other things that I love. And he's like, no, man, you're locked in. You aren't this guy. You're that guy. Be that guy. I'm like, okay, fine. I can be that guy. I can be that guy. So
yeah, someday I'll do that.
I envy your ability to bounce around. That's cool. But yeah, Shattered Circle. That sounds badass.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear what you think about it. And before I let you go, X or Twitter at Mike Bakhoven. I've got MikeBakhoven.com and Facebook is Bakhoven Books.
Yeah, the reason Slotko opened books is because there's a very talented guy who makes pottery whose name is Mike Bakhoven too. So if you go to facebook.com/Mike Bakhoven, you can find some neat handmade art, but that nice. Ain't
Bakhoven.
yeah. I've talked to him. He's a nice guy. You know, I think I'm friends with him on Facebook, and yeah, he's, you know, it's a unique name. So we share something in common, I guess.
Yeah. For me, there's a very famous Scottish folk singer, I think. And a politician in Great Britain that is way more famous than me. but I appreciate you joining me, man. And anytime you want to come back, we didn't even get to killing it. So.
Oh yeah. It's a pleasure. I appreciate it. Love talking horror anytime I can. So yeah, it's a pleasure, man. Thank you.
All right, man. Good night, everybody.